The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
FedEx issues an earnings warning and the stock is getting crushed. The phrase gets tossed around a lot, but we are not exaggerating in this situation. That stock off by 20%. Frank Holland joins us right now with more. And Frank, a lot of questions about what happened here and whether this is a FedEx problem or really a systemic one.
Yeah, certainly a lot of questions about this report and what it means for the entire economy. Let's start with FedEx. Shares plummeting, as you mentioned, after a revenue and EPS miss. Profit 33 below estimates in this earnings warning. CEO Raj Subramaniam on Mad Money last night, when asked if we were on the brink of a worldwide recession, he said yes, saying a major factor is a slowdown in China after COVID lockdowns.
Now let's get over to Germany. The government has begun what may be a series of historic takeovers to try and avert a collapse of the energy industry. Regulators are seizing control of a Russian oil major Rosneft, German oil refineries.
According to Reuters, the U.S. is considering new sanctions against China to stop the country from invading Taiwan. Biden administration is also focused on getting other countries to follow, especially partners in Asia and Europe. But the U.S. could have a hard time getting support due to China's central role in the global economy.
California is suing Amazon, accusing the world's largest retailer of alleged antitrust law violations.
That's right. The state's attorney general claims the company's practices stifle competitors while driving up online prices. Amazon serves roughly 25 million people in California alone. And while the lawsuit is restricted to the Golden State, it could have significant implications nationwide.
Another disappointing report on inflation as prices unexpectedly rose in August and remain near a 40-year high. The consumer price index for August was up 8.3% compared to 1 year ago as the cost of almost everything keeps going up.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
A persistently high inflation report this week and bad earnings report from FedEx, warning of a global recession sent stocks plunging. There was hope the inflation rate would begin to subside. Instead, with fiscal spending on steroids in Washington, inflation remains stubbornly high as fiscal policy is at odds with monetary policy. It's widely expected that the Fed will raise the Fed funds rate by 75 basis points next week, and that will take the Fed funds rate to 3%. There's more bad news on the employment front as more companies are announcing hiring freezes or laying off workers as the Fed vows to keep raising interest rates. Mortgage rates top 6% this week as the real estate market takes a hit as mortgage rates head higher. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Gina Martin Adams from Bloomberg joins me on the show this week. Gina discusses the current technical recession, but believes it will not be that bad, given that there are no excesses in the economy. Gina favors energy, value, and small cap stocks. Following Gina is energy expert Robert Bryce. Robert discusses why renewables will not work by themselves, and the key to going green is going to be nuclear. Finally, Chris Poplavin and Chris Sheridan will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's find out the key stories moving the markets this week with Ryan Poplavin.
From soft to hard, I think that's safe to say is the theme of this week as investors cope with the paradigm shift that a soft landing may no longer be possible after some of the news this week. We had started the week off a technical rally in stocks. Before the Consumer Price Index was announced on Tuesday, the S&P 500 had rallied 5.2% in 4 days, so a very strong rally to be sure. Unfortunately, what investors were expecting, given the continued weakness in energy, was a lower CPI change, a Consumer Price Index change in August versus July. At face value, investors got what they wanted, with a month-over-month increase of just 0.1%. However, the consensus was for a 0.1% drop. Still not too big of a deal, right? The issue was that the core inflation rate, excluding energy and food, went up a lot, up 0.6%, double the consensus. The CPI was largely influenced by a 0.7% increase in the shelter index, which is 40% of the total increase in core. The year-over-year rate went up to 6.3% from 5.9% in July and not down, which defeats the peak inflation story. Let's talk about the reaction stocks and bonds that day. The two-year note yield was at 3.5% before the report, spiked up to 3.75%. The S&P 500 had its fifth largest point drop in history. Now, the Fed funds futures aren't just predicting a 75-point increase next week at the FOMC meeting, but are now calculating the possibility, a very minute one, maybe 30% chance of a full point hike. I doubt that, but it's a big flip pre-Jackson Hole when investors were predicting only a 50-point hike before Powell's tough talk. With the core inflation data moving away from the Fed, it's likely now that next week won't just be the only aggressive hike, and there is serious doubt from investors like Jeff Gundlach, founder of Double Line Capital, that the Fed will not oversteer and create a policy mistake at the pace they are going. Additionally, adding some fuel to the bearish sentiment and shift towards a hard landing thinking was the earnings warnings this week from FedEx. FedEx cut earnings estimates and withdrew its outlook for the rest of the year, with the CEO saying he expects a worldwide recession. The FedEx warning follows on other warnings from Eastman Chemical, Nucor, and Arconic. Following the dire comments from such cyclical names, materials were the worst performing sector, down 6.7%, followed by real estate down 6.5%, and communications down 6.4%. Energy and healthcare were the best of the worst, down 2.6% for energy and 2.4% for healthcare. Year to date now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 15.2%. The S&P 500 down 18.7%, and the NASDAQ Composite is now down 26.8%. It's hard to imagine a Fed put at this point, with inflation increasing in core readings. We see the prospect of a soft landing as a very difficult option at this point, and I think others have begun to reach that same conclusion this week. Jeff Gundlach had an interesting point this week at the Future Proof conference I went to. He said, "If the Fed oversteers and missed the ball on inflation last year, what chance is there they'll oversteer on the downside and magically stop at the disinflationary rate of only their 2% target?" Jeff posits the Fed will cause a hard landing and will see inflation drop into the negatives when all is said and done, and mentioned he was buying long-term treasuries just last week. The yield curve is inverted, and while most talk about the 2- and 10-year spread, which ended this week at 43 basis points, Chris Poplavas sent me a chart yesterday that showed the 2- and 30-year spread is the most inverted since 2000. Jeff also mentioned that a 50 basis point inversion of the 210 is a good recession sign. So we're pretty close here. To sum up this week, investors were gripped by the paradigm shift away from a soft landing towards a hard landing scenario, as the Fed will be lead footing that brake for some time until they get a clear reversal in inflationary trends. We've heard this already before. The Fed meets next week on the 20th and 21st. It will be very interesting to hear the message from Powell, as well as where the new dot plot paints the picture for long-term rates. Up next, Gina Martin Adams to give us her analysis on the markets.
Just based on history, the odds of a hard landing are pretty high. If you look at some of the leading indicators, particularly in the housing market, what they're showing is that the Fed has already tightened too much. And as Milton Friedman says, policy only affects economic conditions on a long and variable lag. So we haven't seen it flow through the numbers yet, but the housing market is telling us that in the coming months and quarters, we will see it flow from the housing market into the broader economy. And we will see, call it a nonlinear increase in unemployment. And look, when unemployment is increasing, it's virtually impossible for consumer spending and therefore broad economic growth to accelerate. And the market trades on top of broad economic growth. So it's really hard for us to be bullish.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says contact us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market took a bit of a dive this week with some high numbers on inflation the market wasn't anticipated. Where are we going from here, and what will be the impact of further Fed rate hikes? Joining us on the program from Bloomberg is Gina Martin Adams. Gina, I want to begin with two issues. One, corporate earnings. How will that be affected if the economy slows down, higher rates? And two, the impact of a rising dollar on foreign earnings for a lot of these S&P companies. Let's begin with those.
I think that's a great place to start, Jim, as I do think the market is, frankly, quite nervous about Fed policy, but becoming more nervous about the impact of that increase in interest rates on the economic outlook and what that might mean for the earnings stream. And we've done a good bit of work on this over the last couple of weeks. You know, I'd say first, I think the market, the investor base in general is a bit worried, a bit maybe too worried about the outlook for earnings amidst recession, because the last few recessions pre-pandemic and even including the pandemic were so devastating for earnings. We have this recency bias that presumes that earnings are always inevitably halved or worse in an environment of economic recession. But when we look back in the long-term history, what we find is every recession has very meaningfully different results on the earnings stream. As a matter of fact, you can find recessions going back to 1960 that ranged in impact on earnings from earnings may have fallen as little as 4% to earnings clearly in the great financial crisis dropped close to 75%. So the range is very vast. Our view is that we've been in a technical recession so far this year. It's been very light with two consecutive quarters of GDP contraction. That light kind of recession is likely to continue, maybe worsen a bit going forward, but there's very little evidence of excess in the economy that needs to be removed. And it is usually those excesses that create massive downdrafts in earnings. So our thought on earnings is, you know, we're currently modeling earnings will actually hold in around 0% growth. The exact number right now in our model is about 4% growth over the next 12 months. As the economy slows, but the corporate earnings series sort of reflects just a mere slowdown, not a massive removal of excess or a financial crisis like we had in 2001 or 2009, and certainly not a pandemic shutdown like we had in 2020. So it looks like a pretty moderate outlook for earnings. You know, that said, what's happening in the market now is really a valuation reset reflecting a new landscape for interest rates. And I don't think that's likely to change anytime soon. So valuations may remain suppressed as earnings continue to grow at a relatively slow pace, which is not necessarily great for the outlook for stocks. It creates a pretty choppy outlook. If I should just move right on to your second question with respect to the dollar, I think this has become an incredibly hot topic among the equity investor base over the course of the last couple of months, and rightfully so. We do a transcript analysis every quarter in the midst of earnings season, and we found that for the first time in more than a year, inflation mentions in the second quarter earnings season transcripts actually fell a little bit. So corporates are suggesting that inflation is no longer quite as hot a topic as it was and persistently was increasing as a hot topic and a problematic area of risk for earnings. But what replaced inflation mentions in terms of frequency was actually dollar mentions and currency mentions by corporates. This clearly reflects the massive acceleration that we've seen in the dollar for the last year that has only continued to break to new highs, especially versus other major currencies such as the euro, which is creating a bit of volatility in the earnings landscape. Now, what we find is about a third of companies in the S&P 500, so the most multinational companies in the S&P 500, are actually exposed to the dollar on the downside because they're major exporters. The result is two-thirds of companies in the S&P 500 may receive some degree of benefit from the dollar gaining because they're major importers. Now, they haven't been able to benefit much in this environment of inflation and supply constraints, but nonetheless, they do tend to benefit. So the real result on earnings for dollar is somewhat mixed, but it is absolutely a source of volatility because we do have a very open economy filled with major exporters and importers. And many companies are referencing currency as an area of earnings volatility to watch over the course of the next 6 to 12 months.
So I want to move on to, and let's go back to this recession. It's a technical recession because two contracting quarters. But what makes this a little unusual, I'd like to get your comments here, is the unemployment rate is this low. Yeah. Typically, you see the Fed raising interest rates when the economy is heating up. This time they're doing it when it was rolling over. And secondly, look at the unemployment rate. I mean, it did go up to 3.7, but you know, that's considered full employment.
Yeah, it is. And our view is we may actually go into a period of time where the unemployment rate rises a little bit, but not nearly as much as it typically does in recession, partly because we've been through such an anomalous environment. You know, the Fed is in an awkward position because they're having to raise rates as the economy is already naturally slowing down. They're having to raise rates to combat inflation and to catch up after their pandemic era policies kept rates at an extraordinarily low levels and accommodation at large with the balance sheet as well, sort of at extremes. And so they're catching back up to reality and then may have to actually tighten somewhat to combat some embedded inflation pressures. And you're absolutely right. This is a very bizarre recession because this is a recession so far that is predominantly driven by a contraction in fiscal spending, which likewise is very unusual. Fiscal spending has contracted in a few recessions going back to 1960, but certainly not all of them, and certainly not in the most recent few. We're used to the fiscal policy having contracted mid-cycle and then being able to come in sort of ride to the rescue to help soothe the economy in a period of recessionary downturn. The presumption, I think, on the part of the consensus is that the recession will worsen because PCE or personal consumption expenditures, consumer spending lines will be dampened because of high input costs, potentially higher unemployment rate and the like. But if you look at long-term periods of history, the 2009 recession was the only recession since 1960 in which nominal and real consumption fell. Usually the consumer merely slows down their growth rate, business investment contracts, and that creates some form of recession. So it's still really uncertain as to how this recession is really going to play out. The consumer so far is hanging in there very well because the unemployment rate is extremely low and they've also had a decade to repair their balance sheets. So the household is in incredibly good position. I think the unemployment rate will rise a little bit over the next 6 to 12 months because initial claims have been rising in line with a historical recessionary experience, but it's yet to be seen. And I do think we want to account for the idea that this cycle is unlike any other cycle. And looking particularly at the most recent recessionary experiences over the last couple of decades is probably not as relevant to framing our thoughts on the outlook as we would like.
I want to go on to interest rates. The wider consensus, they go three quarters. The Fed, Gina, does not have a good track record of bringing us to soft landings. What are the chances they repeat their past mistakes?
Oh, I think that the chances are very high. The Fed most likely will have to over-tighten to achieve their policy objective of constraining inflation and inflation expectations. In this particular cycle, I would say, is very prone to potential policy error because we've been through such an anomaly with respect to the pandemic. Rates were arguably held too low for too long, fighting a pandemic that was no longer materially impacting demand. And there is a chance that the Fed will end up having to hike too far too fast to contain inflation, which will certainly crimp demand to some degree. So I'd say that the chances of a policy error are relatively high this time around. You know, I think, though, there's also above average chance that demand will hold up better in the face of increasing interest rates than many anticipate. I completely sympathize with the notion that change in interest rate policy has and will continue to have pretty onerous impacts on asset prices, because that's the predominant area where policy truly, you know, manifests itself over the course of the last few years. I think we're already seeing contraction in housing and autos that has only moderately slowed down economic growth. We'll likely continue to see that as we traditionally do with interest rate increases, but I think there's a chance that the economic reflection of rate increases is also not what we're all presuming it will be, because this environment is just quite frankly so bizarre relative to those past. We're clearly dealing with a tremendous supply shock globally, and a lot of rethinking of supply chains globally by corporates. And that's having some pretty severe consequences that we don't talk about enough. And it's certainly very unique to this cycle relative to past cycles.
Yeah, one of the things I know here in California, we're going more towards EVs and other things like that on clean energy. But Gina, I've had to wait 10 months to get a car, and we're still waiting for another one. So this supply chain, as we're seeing more companies like Intel talking about building 2-plant chip factories here, is companies bring those factories here, what are going to be the inflationary impact? For in other words, it's more expensive to produce here than it is in China, but because of supply chain issues, we almost have to do this.
Yeah. I think it's one. I wrote a long-term report about the secular outlook for inflation, and we've been updating it over the course of the last 2 years now. And what I think is happening with inflation is really a reflection of what I call the three Ds: deglobalization, which is, you know, one of the predominant drivers of the supply chain crisis, was really kicked into high gear as a result of the pandemic, and it's created one of the major drivers of inflation that is likely to be here to stay for quite some time. As those companies migrate their production facilities to new locations around the world, it creates an environment for much stronger business investment in general, which means the sort of demand push inflation is faster as well. So you highlight the labor cost aspect of producing product in the United States is going to be higher. Real estate cost is potentially higher. They won't have the transportation costs, but that cost will be offset through higher costs in the interim, which is one of the major pushes of inflation that I think we need to acknowledge as a long-term driver. You know, the others are certainly decarbonization as one issue. You highlighted you've been waiting for a car for a while, but also the, you know, policy push to move into electric vehicles is very clear. The policy push to combat carbon emissions and general climate change is also clear. That will likely have longer term inflationary consequences as opposed to deflationary consequences as we transition to alternatives from traditional energy supply. And then, you know, the third is demographic. And this is the third D that I think very few people actually refer to enough, is we are undergoing a demographic shift, and we're going into a demographic climate, which means labor supply is very scarce, not only in the US, but relatively scarce globally. Demographic shifts are impacting the availability of labor across the world. And the result of that is also somewhat inflationary. So I do think we need to be prepared for a higher for longer inflation landscape. Do we need to be at 8-10% forever? Absolutely not. That's probably more a reflection of the short term than the long term, but we may settle in at a much faster pace of inflation than most of us have become accustomed to.
Yeah, the word I'm hearing is that instead of a 2% inflation rate, maybe 4 or 5 is going to be realistic given all these macro events. Gina, given these variables that you see right now, what would you be doing as an investor?
Yeah, Well, our sort of investment strategies have been pretty consistent all year. We've been very much leaning into value and away from growth. We've been leaning into small caps and away from large caps. Much of that really reflects sort of structural excesses that had developed in valuations, reflecting very low interest rates in the growth and large cap segment, but also creating opportunities in the value and small cap segment. Just major discounts have emerged, especially in small caps over the course of the last year and a half. So those are pretty consistent and have been generally our positions all year. Our sector strategy is still very consistent with the last time we spoke, where energy still tops the list on sectors. As much as energy has outperformed the index over the course of 2022, it still looks best positioned to continue to perform well in an environment where inflation remains somewhat sticky and rates are rising, where the large cap growth sectors such as communications, consumer discretionary, even technology, all fall toward the bottom of the spectrum, given their longer duration, more tendency to fall in the growth category and spend more R&D relative to sales in comparison to their other brethren.
All right. Well, Gina, I read most of your stuff on my Bloomberg terminal, but if our listeners would like to follow your work, I think you're on LinkedIn and Twitter.
I am. Thank you very much for that. You can find me on LinkedIn, Gina Martin Adams, and my Twitter handle is also at Gina Martin Adams, and I'm absolutely happy to interact with you in those social spaces.
All right. Well, Gina, as always, thanks for coming on the program. All the best and have a great rest of the year.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, California is being on an emergency basis as a heat wave has overwhelmed the grid system. We've been urged to turn our temperatures up. If you have an EV, you're not to charge it during normal working hours. And this is just the beginning. It's not just California, it's elsewhere as things are looking bleak in Europe. Well, let's find out what is causing it and what could be a possible solution. Joining us on the program is Robert Bryce. He's author of a book, A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations, and Power Hungry, the Myth of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. Robert, we're seeing all these ESG policies backfire. We saw in Sri Lanka, they went from self-sufficiency in food to shortages of food. We're seeing in Germany, where Berliners are going outside the city, chopping down wood in the forest to stay warm this summer. They're asking people not to take showers more than 5 minutes. And then we've got, of course, in England, where they have all kinds of problems with electricity and natural gas. I mean, how did we get in this mess?
We flipped the whole equation onto its head that we in California, the fifth largest economy in the world, they don't have enough juice to meet demand. So they have to use less. Well, how did they get there? Well, it's because California exactly copied Europe's model. And as you know, Europe, well, I want to talk about Europe. Europe has driven itself into the ditch. What did California and Europe do? And what largely does the Biden administration want to do? It's they've overinvested in renewables, underinvested in hydrocarbons, shuttered their coal and nuclear baseload plants, and relied too heavily on imports. I mean, this is exactly what Europe did. It's what I testified in front of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee last November. I said, don't do what Europe is doing. And now Europe is facing just a total economic meltdown. And California, not so bad, but still California's electric rates are skyrocketing. All of it's regressive on consumers. And it's just a very bad situation, Jim. And I think it's just fundamentally because policymakers don't understand and don't bother to care to understand how our energy and power systems work.
Robert, explain to me, when it comes to electricity, we have coal fire plants, natural gas fire plants, hydroelectric, we have renewables, and we have nuclear. And we know the thing about renewables, which is wind and solar, they're intermittent. They don't always work. They're not very efficient from an energy point of view. So tell me, what are these guys thinking when you have a stable system that was powered by coal, nat gas, and nuclear, and we had like four or five sources of electricity? We're getting rid of them, as we are in California, and we're substituting these renewables, which are intermittent. And I just read in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, they're having trouble trying to get the wind farms put in because the environmentalists object to it. So how in the hell is this going to work?
Well,
I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
It's not working. And what is happening in Europe and California should be a stark warning to policymakers across the United States and around the world. These examples of these grid crises and energy crises that are underway, these are just very obvious examples of the fact that in overinvesting in renewables just leads your economy into the ditch. But I think, Jim, I mean, to get to kind of the heart of your question, you didn't put it quite this way, but there is a religious devotion to these ideas around renewable energy, and they are very appealing. And you look at the Gallup polling data, and the renewables are incredibly popular politically. Something like 70% of Americans want more wind, 80% want more solar. They have this idea, oh, this is natural, this is clean, this is, you know, back to the earth, la, 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 la. And politicians see those numbers, and so they campaign on them. But then the politicians aren't the ones that have to run the grid. But I will say here in the U.S., and then I hope we can talk about Europe. I do see some positive things that are happening, Jim, and I am very heartened by it. On September 1st, the California legislature voted to appropriate funds to keep the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant open. That plant is critical to the grid in California, provides nearly 10% of the electricity in the state, and of course, it's zero emissions and baseload and is important for the resilience of the California grid. So that was positive, and the governor, Gavin Newsom, was in favor of this. So that's a very positive thing. But the other thing happened just last Friday in Michigan. Holtec International, which is based in New Jersey, they own the Palisades nuclear plant in Michigan. That plant was prematurely shuttered on May 20th. They just announced on Friday that they want to keep the plant open, and they're seeking federal funds under the money that was appropriated under the Infrastructure Act that passed last year. And on Friday, Governor Whitmer in Michigan sent a letter to the DOE saying, we support this. We want to keep this plant open. So there are finally, a year ago this month, September of last year, two nuclear plants in Illinois were saved, the Byron and Dresden plants, again, by an act of the Illinois legislature. That measure passed by a single vote. But nevertheless, those plants have been saved, and that's saving consumers money because of the price of natural gas has gone up so much. So there are signs that energy realism is coming to the fore in several locations, and that's very positive.
You know, the thing that surprises me, and this is a quote from Michael Schellenberger, who's talking about the land mass for renewables is 300 times what it is for fossil fuels. The amount of things like copper and things like that have to go in, rare earth minerals, we don't have enough of them. And when you talk about solar, a lot of our solar panels come from China.
Absolutely.
So what are we thinking here? Because you're taking something that doesn't always work. I mean, yeah, it's really nice, and you think, oh, this is clean, it isn't polluting, but there's a lot of pollution that goes into the creation of these windmills and solar panels. It's called mining.
Sure.
You have to have minerals to make this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. And I think that the other key issue here, and you touched on it, is supply chains. Where are these rare earth elements coming? Who makes them? Well, and just as important, what about the rare earth element magnets, the high strength magnets that are needed to build electric vehicles and wind turbines? The Department of Energy earlier this year published a report that said over 90% of the neodymium iron boron magnets that are produced globally come from China. there is no way toward electrifying our auto fleet or increasing the amount of number of wind turbines without dealing directly with suppliers in China. Second, on the solar side, there was a report that just came out from the UN, in fact, just a few days ago, the UN Office on Human Rights, pointing out that in Xinjiang, China, which supplies nearly half of the solar-grade polysilicon globally, the UN confirmed earlier reports about the human rights abuses there, including genocide. And that is the word used by the State Department and other departments in the United States, other agencies, big federal agencies. They have called what's happening in Xinjiang genocide. So our solar industry, which enjoys this incredibly favorable image, is in fact relying on a province in China where slave labor and genocide is happening today. I mean, it is truly this. I don't know what the right word to describe it, Jim. This kind of cognitive dissonance. I don't use that phrase very often, but you know, let's look at the reality here. And the supply chain on this industry is tainted and heavily tainted.
Yeah, I want to go now to Europe because in an issue, I had a car that I ordered, and it took me 10 months to get it. My wife has a car that's ordered. It's still not complete in Germany. I don't know how they're going to be able to make stuff there, but the way things are going.
Europe is in such a dire straits. I mean, and you know, they're toying with price caps on Russian oil, Russian gas, subsidizing the consumers across the continent. Well, where are those governments going to get that money? They're digging themselves into a massive financial hole. But one of the most recent developments that I think is really interesting, and I want to talk about fertilizer, but just last Friday, a group called Eurometal, which is an association of about 50 metals producers in Europe, the non-ferrous metals producers, aluminum, zinc, etc. They sent a letter to the European Commission, and the memo says, Europe's non-ferrous metals producers call for emergency EU action to prevent permanent deindustrialization from spiraling electricity and gas prices. They wrote, Europe's worsening energy crisis and its existence are an existential threat to our future. They point out 50% of the EU's aluminum and zinc capacity has already been forced offline, and there's similar numbers across copper, nickel, silicon, ferroalloys, and here's one of the punchlines. Producers face electricity and gas costs over 10 times higher than last year, far exceeding the sales price for their products. We know from experience that once a plant is closed, it very often becomes a permanent situation, as reopening implies significant uncertainty and cost. So here are some of the base metal companies that are the foundation for numerous industries in Europe, automobiles, beverages, manufacturing, are telling the European Commission, we're shuttering our smelters, and if they shut down, they're gone. They're not coming back. And if that's the case, then all the workers in those plants won't be getting a paycheck. And the plants that depend, the downstream plants that depend on the metals produced by those plants, are going to shutter because they don't have the raw materials. So the knock-on effects of what is laying in wait for Europe, it is so scary, Jim. And I've written things, I've done a few short videos on TikTok, on Twitter. They're getting a lot of uptake because I don't see these issues being discussed as much as they should be in the big media outlets in America.
Oh, they're absolutely silent about it. In fact, the Wall Street Journal just did an article this week, and they talked about the leases granted by administrations coming out of World War II.
That was a remarkable piece. I mean, I was just in San Antonio. I spoke yesterday to the gas producers or the gas processors, and I presented those graphics that showed effectively under the Biden administration, in the first 19 months in office, what was it? They have leased no federal land for oil and gas or hydrocarbon exploration, which is just truly stunning.
The thing that really surprises me, they're saying, well, this is good because it's driving up the cost and it's going to push us towards green energy, EVs. Well, Robert, you and I know that an EV here in California, where the weather's good, an EV works very well. But if you get back in the cold weather, Michigan, New York, or someplace like that, it doesn't work as well. Why aren't we talking about hybrids as a transition vehicle as the cost of energy keeps going up? Versus EVs, which we know don't work in a lot of places.
Well, and let me follow on that last part of it, Jim, because the other part, I spend a lot of time in rural America. I travel quite a bit, and I speak to a lot of rural electric cooperatives. And so I meet ranchers and farmers and small town merchants, and I travel to, I was in Nacogdoches in Texas last week, or last month rather. And, you know, I drive around in those small towns. I don't see any Teslas. I don't see any Volts. I don't see any electric vehicles. This is part of the urban-rural divide where the liberals who are tend to be Democrats and wealthy drive electric vehicles. The average household income for an EV buyer is $140,000 a year. That's twice the national average, which is about $65,000 a year. And we've been subsidizing the purchasing of these vehicles for years. But they're not, these aren't cars for working class folks. They're for the elites. And I don't use that word very often. But more important, and maybe just to follow on that, I don't see any horse trailers being pulled by Teslas. I see F-150s. I see Rams. I see Silverados. I don't see cattle trailers or hay or feed, loads of feed or those things that make America work, right? The food and fiber production. These industries are not relying on electric powered vehicles. I was talking to a guy who was in farming. Where was he? Just yesterday. Yeah, when it's time to combine and harvest the wheat, we have that combine. It's out there running 24 hours a day. He said, "You think we're going to come in and we're going to charge that thing for 12 hours? Are you kidding me? That's not going to happen." So it's again, I think, Jim, there's a very big disconnect and a very worrisome one when it comes to these policies around the most important industries in America, which are our energy and power systems, and how they want to transform them without understanding what that entails.
Yeah, because you've written about this in your book. You want to look at poverty and judge it. It's electricity.
Yeah.
And a lot of the world doesn't have that. But, you know, one of the things that really surprises me is rather than connecting the dots and say, all right, Newsom wants no more gas combustion cars after 2035. I think it's 2030. You're not going to be able to drive a diesel truck in this state. They don't think through, okay, if we're going to do that, how are we going to get the electricity to power all this stuff?
Right.
And but they issue these mandates and just say, well, everything is like 2030. What is it about 2030 that we're going to do an energy transition in a decade? I mean, we didn't go from horse and buggy to cars, gas stations, and freeways in 10 years. It took decades.
Right. And I think that that's an absolutely critical point, which is that energy transitions, and I'm using Václav Smil's phrase, he says, they don't happen over years. They are, what do you say? They are protracted affairs. They happen not over years, but over decades. And that's the reality. And 35-38% of the global electricity is generated with coal. Well, that's the same fuel that Edison used on Pearl Street 140 years ago. In fact, it was September of 1882, so it's almost exactly 140 years ago. And yet coal endures. Why? Because it's a low cost fuel. It's geographically widespread. Prices aren't affected by any OPEC like entities. It's the perfect fuel for making electricity. And that's why we see around the world, coal demand has been soaring. I mean, I know you're an investor and you advise people on investing. Who would have thought? And we talk about the rises in price of natural gas and oil, right? So gas is up, what, 3X since it bottomed. Oil's up about 3X roughly. The price of coal out of the Newcastle port in Australia is up eightfold. In early 2021, it was at $50. Today, it's selling for over $400. So this idea that we've gone beyond coal and that we're not going to use coal, it's just not true. It's a big fat lie is what it is. And yet there are very powerful moneyed interests in non-governmental organizations, climate activist groups who are pushing this anti-coal regime at the time when, in fact, the world is rushing back to coal, including Europe, and looking for any kind of hydrocarbon they can because the price of natural gas is so high. So what we're seeing is a return to the past. In fact, I think that where this push toward decarbonization is taking a huge blow because countries around the world are looking at their people and saying, well, we don't want the lights to go out. We're going to burn whatever we have to burn to keep the lights on.
Yeah, because really what they're talking about, and a lot of these people are against growth, it's deindustrialization, which we're seeing. I mean, if you don't have electricity, you're not going to make stuff,
yeah.
Period. I want to talk about the energy situation and what we're trying to do politically. I mean, what kind of scares me is I've got a graph on my Bloomberg of the SPR, and we're down to like 1984 levels. I mean, this was put in place for emergencies, things like hurricanes where platforms in the Gulf of Mexico are disrupted, or acts of war. But we're drawing this down just up to the election.
Didn't you know that the Democrats declared the November midterms as a national emergency? That high gasoline prices are a national emergency. That's the cynicism of the whole thing. But let me, if I could, Jim, I just want to direct us back before we leave Europe, if you don't mind, because there are two other things that are happening in Europe that I think are absolutely essential to understand. First is the fertilizer issue. And if your listeners are want some more information, I recommend they can go to the crugroup.com. It's a European-based outfit. They have something called the Nitrogen Cost Tracker, and you can sign up and get the information for free. It's crugroup.com. They reported just about 2 weeks ago, and I've written about this, and I had a piece in Newsweek just a few days ago, about 70% of Europe's fertilizer capacity has been shuttered because of the high cost of natural gas. Ammonia prices are up fivefold since the beginning of 2021. And that, what else has happened? China began restricting fertilizer exports in October of last year. Russia began restricting exports in March of this year. Africa, and one of the points I make in the Newsweek article, the head of the African Development Bank wrote an open letter about 3 weeks ago at pointing out that Africa is facing famine. And he said that right now, Africa has a food shortage of at least 30 million metric tons of grain. So what we're seeing in the knock-on effects, and yes, Russia is a big problem, and Putin's invasion is a big problem. It's one of the reasons why natural gas prices are so high. But remember, the gas prices, nat gas prices in Europe were rising before the invasion, because the Europeans invested too much in renewables. They had low wind speeds for, you know, weeks in a row, so they burned a lot of gas. So they drove themselves into the ditch. But this fertilizer issue is one that is going to have continuing impacts on global food supplies for years to come, because Europe has quit making fertilizer. As my friend John Harpole, who I had on the Power Hungry podcast a couple of weeks ago, he said fertilizer production in Europe is over, because they can't make fertilizer at a profit there. In fact, the CRU group has a great graphic. They show that at current natural gas prices, producing a ton of ammonia will result in a negative margin of $2,000 a ton. So the impacts on industry, on fertilizer, on electricity costs, on the half of Britain's pubs looking at shuttering. I mean, these are societal crises that are happening all at the same time. And I don't think they're being appreciated for the severity of what could happen. And yet we hear, you know, continuing this, frankly, propaganda from a lot of policymakers about, oh, well, we need to decarbonize. Well, why don't you look around the world and see the danger that lurks here? And you need to sober up, and you need to do it right damn now.
You know, that's amazing, because the stuff you and I are talking about, Robert, you don't see it anywhere, hardly anywhere in the mainstream media. They just don't cover it.
You know, I've been a reporter my whole career, Jim. I've never had a real job. I used to think the liberal media was a fiction, and I take no pleasure in saying this, and I don't identify as a Republican or a Democrat. I'm disgusted. But the liberal media, it's real, and the things that they will not write about, and particularly the land use conflicts around renewable energy. The New York State is arguably the epicenter of the backlash against renewables, big wind and big solar. The New York Times won't cover that. They won't write about it. I've read the New York Times since I was a child. They, and I follow it closely, they will not write about those conflicts. The same National Public Radio, their coverage of this has been terrible, absolutely awful. I wrote a piece for Quillette about how terrible their coverage has been on the rural backlash against why local people are fighting renewables. And there was no sensibility about, well, these people have rights and land rights. Instead, the whole thing was, you know, these rural rubes. That was the gist of it. They're so dumb. Don't they know these wind turbines and solar panels are good for them? So there is a lack of understanding, and there's a lack of just straightforward coverage of these issues. And I'm doing the best I can to cover them, but it's a big issue. And I agree with you that we're not hearing about this to the extent that we should.
You know, it was amazing because, Robert, I think it was right around April or May of 2020, I wrote a story from oil glut to oil crisis. And at that time, what I was seeing was the lack of investment by the industry itself. We had gone through a bear market beginning with the Saudi oil war in 2014. So companies, as the price of energy came down, they just stopped. They didn't have the cash flow. And then you add on top of that this strong ESG movement that came and then accelerated with the Biden administration is just aggravated and made matters worse.
Yeah. And I can't quite explain it. I mean, I knew that the Biden administration was going to be a big change from the Trump administration. I had no idea that it was going to be, frankly, as extreme as it is. And I do think that that is the right word, that these, and also just the way they couched some of these issues. But I don't want to come off as a partisan. That's not my interest. What I'm for cheap, abundant, reliable energy and power, full stop. Because why? Because expensive energy is the enemy of the poor. And I've had people here in Austin tell me, you know, liberal Democrats, oh, well, energy's too cheap. I mean, I had this very discussion, not, you know, a year and a half ago or so, someone I'd known a long time. And I just was gobsmacked when I heard that come out of this person's mouth. And I remember it very vividly because there is this bias that, oh, we should make energy more expensive because, you know, we're using too much. And I just thought, holy cow, this is just... so blind to the realities of the world and to the fact that any increase in the cost of gasoline or diesel fuel or electricity or propane, that is a regressive tax on the poor. And in a time when inflation on all fronts is hurting the poor and the middle class, and yet you want to make an energy more expensive? Well, I'm sorry, we're splitting the sheets on this one because I think, you know, not only is it wrong, I find it a vile and just a really a truly disgusting worldview because it betrays your lack of understanding of what makes the world work. And America became a powerhouse because we had cheap, abundant, reliable energy. And to deny that or wish that it were somewhere, some other way, well, I'm sorry, that's not me. We're gonna split the sheets on that one.
Robert, what is it about the politicians? I mean, you know, these people in Congress have got to be looking at what's going on in Germany, Netherlands, Sri Lanka, England, and even California. Is it just, like you said, it's kind of like a religious devotion? Well, we ignore that, or we're going to keep doing the same thing, but expect a different outcome. The definition of stupidity.
Now, there is this religious type of belief that we've done too much, that we've lived too well, and we have to do less, be less, use less. So these ideas around catastrophic climate change and the religious affiliation that a lot of people have to that idea. I'm not saying climate change isn't an issue. Climate change is a concern. It's not our only concern. But these kinds of biases around this kind of religious affiliation are driving a lot of this money and momentum and media attention around climate change that all forego any discussion of the incredible benefits we get from hydrocarbons and the fact that we're going to continue needing them for a very long time to come.
You know, it's amazing because we've seen ESG rise to the forefront. The SEC is talking about having companies report their ESG policies, and they're even talking about ESG ratings for individuals. In other words, what kind of car you drive.
That's not going to be. By the way, Jim, you interrupt. You know what ESG stands for?
What's that?
Well, the E stands for emissions and the S and G are silent.
Oh, God. Robert,
you can use that with my compliments.
Oh, okay. So, Robert, where do you think we go from here? Do you think eventually just, you know, like you even had Newsom that is putting in for money to keep Diablo Canyon going, Whitmer for the nuclear reactor.
Palisades plant, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think this... Are you seeing a turnaround or are you seeing a wake up or is this going to get worse?
I do see some positive signs. One of the things I should have included in the positive news on nuclear lately is just in the last few weeks, I don't remember the exact date, but NuScale, which is a company that's developing a new small modular reactor, they had design approval for their reactor from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This is a big deal. I mean, truly, it is a big deal and incredibly positive news for the nuclear sector, because the NRC lately in particular has not been what I believe a fair arbiter in terms of refereeing nuclear and relicensing and so on. And we can go into that if you like. But the fact that they've approved this design, and we've seen the moves to save Diablo Canyon and Palisades, and a year ago the saving of Byron and Dresden, those are incredibly positive in terms of the nuclear business. Now, when it comes to the broader issues around hydrocarbons, a lot of challenges here in the U.S. But the things that are positive that are happening in Europe, remember Liz Truss is the new prime minister there. She promised if she was elected prime minister that she would repeal the ban on hydraulic fracturing. And as far as I recall, it was her first or second day in office. She did exactly that. So this is important. Why? Because Britain now is the first country in Europe to repeal their frack ban. And I think there are seven other countries that still have fracking bans in place. But the fact that Britain has said we're going to repeal it, incredibly important. Second, Britain has large shale gas resources. That now, Truss said also they're going to do more leasing in the North Sea, which they should be doing, obviously. Because why? Because energy security. Now, in the wake of the Putin invasion of Ukraine, energy security requires drilling. Full stop. You're going to have to drill if you want to have energy security. And Britain is importing more than half of their natural gas. So the positive news is they've repealed the fracking ban. They have huge shale resources on shore in Britain, but they have to drill, and they need to start now, because it'll take them a year roughly to kind of delineate the prospect where they need to drill, where the pipelines offtake capacity. But it'll be 2 or 2.5 years before they are able to produce significant quantities of hydrocarbons. And by that, I mean in the billions of cubic feet per day. And they're going to need 3 or 3.5 BCF a day in order to supplant all their imported gas. But they're starting. And by God, that's great. When's the best time to plant a tree? Yesterday, well, or 20 years ago. And when's the next best time? Today. The Financial Times had a really very good piece, a disturbing one, I thought, just last week. And I used it in a presentation I gave in San Antonio yesterday. It was on September 7th. I'll just read this. It's just one sentence. The average UK household electricity price is at least 30% higher than in many of its European neighbors, with the country's greater reliance on natural gas for power generation hitting consumers hard. And then they have a graphic showing that Europe, that the UK now has the most expensive electricity in Europe, far higher than Germany, which had that distinction for a long time. But consumers in the UK are now paying over 60 cents per kilowatt hour, Jim. The average residential price here in the US is about 13 or 14 cents. I mean, this is crazy town, and it's taking a massive toll on the Brits.
Well, I want to give kudos to you. You wrote a book called Power Hungry: The Myth of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. It talks much about it. And your latest book, A Question of Power, Electricity, and the Wealth of Nations. It was amazing, Robert. I'm reading a book by a gentleman, Hall, that came up with the EROI concept, Energy Return on Investment.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about economics. And until we had fossil fuels, economics was about scarcity. And then all of a sudden, fossil fuels come along, and economics changed to supply curves and distribution, who got what of the wealth. And it changed and altered economics, but you can't have economics without energy. You can't produce and you can't grow without energy. Hopefully it's not too late.
I'm an incurable optimist, Jim. My late friend Molly Ivan said she's optimistic to the point of idiocy. And I put myself in that same camp. I mean, we've always muddled through, right? And we need to get on with the muddling here, but we have to have a more urgent approach and understand that when looking at Europe, there, but for the grace of God, goes the U.S. And I unfortunately don't see that kind of urgency in Congress or in the White House, but maybe that's going to happen. But I think the longer this Russia-Ukraine conflict continues, the more likely they're likely will have continue to have severe disruptions, because the Russians, now there are rumors that the Russians will cut off exports of other key materials. The Chinese, I don't think the Chinese want to get too close to the Russians, but you know, the Chinese have also restricted exports of fertilizer. You know, we're in a perilous state right now on a lot of different fronts. And fortunately, the U.S. energy sector is still has a lot of momentum behind it. And they're going to, you know, have to, they're encountering headwinds in terms of the regulatory policymaking side. But, you know, it's a big darn business. And so it's going to take a while for bad policy to leak through. I'm not saying it can't and it won't, but that we're still in an incredibly enviable position, the United States is.
Well, Robert, as we close, I want to mention your books.
There's six of them, Jim. Yeah. They're all my favorites. I have three children. They're all my favorites. My six books, they're all my favorites. And you need to mention my film, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, which is also out. It's a feature-length documentary. It's on all the streaming, major streaming platforms, not on Netflix, but on Roku Channel, Amazon Prime, Google Play, etc. And then I'm now on TikTok. Yes, you heard that right. I'm on TikTok.
Are you dancing, Robert?
Well, I think I might take that up. I think I'm going to start doing some little dance videos. But I'm doing about a minute, which has been a lot of fun. I'm working with my daughter, Mary, who's lovely, and she kind of has goaded me into this. I'd say goaded. No, she's encouraged me to say, Dad, you can talk. Why don't you do these, you know, do short videos and we'll put them on TikTok. So I've been putting them on TikTok, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, and having fun doing it, trying to explain, well, in about a minute, what's going on in about a minute. And that's been fun. So I'm easy to find on the interweb, on Twitter. My handle on TikTok and on Twitter is PWR Hungry, Power Hungry. So encourage your listeners to follow up, subscribe, etc.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, a pleasure having you on the program. Hopefully we start waking up here, at least trying to get this information out, because, you know, the mainstream media is not covering this stuff. They're absolutely, you know, there's crickets in the media covering this.
I think that's generally true. Javier Blas with Bloomberg has, I think, done some really good stuff. I follow him very closely. Javier Blas on Twitter, but he's on Bloomberg. He's done some great, great reporting on this, but he's a rarity. I'll say that.
All right, Robert, thanks so much for joining us on the program. All the best and come back again.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Smart Macro Edition with Chris Poplava, our CIO here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, as we discussed with you a couple of weeks ago, we looked at the housing market as a leading economic indicator and a number of other things that you have been posting on YouTube and our website through our weekly investment videos. This week, you talked about how we are seeing a breaking point for the markets and the economy. And I would definitely say we saw that take place this week when you just look at the action of the stock market, but how interest rates in particular are starting to really crimp economic activity. So tell us about what we're seeing in terms of this breaking point that you're focusing in on.
So when I look across, you know, the last 8 years or so, when you look at short-term rates, like two-year treasuries, all the way to long-term treasuries, out to 30 years, U.S. interest rates have predominantly been under that level. They got close to it in 2018 when Powell was hiking interest rates. We, especially on the long end, got pretty close to it, but not quite at 3.5%. And then we saw a substantial decline in interest rates in the latter part of the year. And then ultimately, a continual decline in 2019 because economic growth was slowing. Usually what we see is that interest rates follow the path of leading economic indicators and reflect economic growth. So when economic growth is rising, yields are generally rising. And when economic growth is slowing, yields are generally falling. And so earlier this year, we kind of saw that 3.5% wall get hit again. And it literally turned U.S. interest rates on a dime back in June, where we saw short-term rates get to that level. Bonds started to rally, interest rates reversed, and that was all the way until, I would say, late July, where yields fell, and now they've since been going up. And they're testing that 3.5% level again, bumping up into that. And a couple of times this week, we saw long-term yields get above that level, and we have seen a few break above that. For example, the two-year treasury is now at 3.86. That has breached the 3.5% level to be one of the highest interest rates we've seen in almost 10 years. The five-year treasury is at 3.62% as of today. So that also has cleared that 3.5% level. But long-term rates, which generally should be reflecting more economic growth and the outlook for economic growth, still are kind of testing that level. The 10-year right now is at 3.45, didn't quite break through that. And the 30-year treasury is at 3.51. So for the long end of the yield curve, we're still seeing that 3.5% act like a ceiling, while the short end is moving continually higher based on Fed expectations of more rate hikes to come. It's largely expected that next week Powell will raise by 75 basis points, and then we're probably going to get another hike in November and then probably another hike in December. So again, that's why the short end of the yield curve is moving up pretty significantly, while we're seeing the long end stall, hitting that threshold of 3.5%, which is still, at least on the long end, acting like a ceiling.
And I often think of interest rates as borrowing costs. So if you just think about it, as interest rates are going up, that means the cost of borrowing money is also going up. So in which case, as we start to see, for example, 30-year mortgage rates move up to the 6% level, then that dramatically increases the cost of borrowing for a mortgage, for a home. Your monthly payment has gone up quite a bit compared to what we just saw, you know, even 1 or 2 years ago. And this is true for the auto industry and for all sorts of economic activity that we see. So as interest rates have moved up so quickly, I mean, this is really starting to have an impact.
It really has, Chris. And the first area that we always see, I wouldn't say always, but generally, housing is the best leading indicator around. And the reason for that is it's so interest rate sensitive. So when the Fed starts to cut interest rates, you typically see housing respond with home sales picking up. And when interest rates rise, you generally see housing slow down as it becomes more and more costly to buy a home. One of the things we are seeing with is, especially, is in new home sales. The reason why we're seeing a significant drop off in new home sales is the uncertainty when you enter into contract to buy a home and when you actually receive the home and are issued your mortgage at the then current rate. Now, so for example, imagine you enter a contract to buy a home. It's not going to be done being built for 6 months. And when you look at the price of the home and where rates are, you basically estimate what you can afford. Imagine if the cost of that payment goes up by 40 or even 30%. And that's what we're seeing. And because of that, that is now pricing people who entered into contract with a builder to buy a home to break that contract as they can no longer afford that home. So we are seeing the supply of new homes rise to nearly the highest level, as we talked about, Chris, last time, since the housing bubble of 2006 and 7. So, you know, we are clearly seeing that strain on housing. And unfortunately, there's no sign of relief. Just this week, when looking at the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, according to Bankrate, it jumped to a new high of 6.28%. So when you think about where it was just a few years ago, it's more than doubled. I mean, this is the highest mortgage rate we have seen in 14 years. Now imagine that, the highest interest rate or borrowing cost, as you said, in 14 years, coupled with some of the highest prices we've seen in homes. So housing is really taking a hit. I do think we're basically going in or already in our housing recession. We're starting to see activity really begin to plummet. And I think we're going to have continual spillover of that into the rest of the economy.
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, it's so important to understand the downstream impacts that come from these higher rates. And as you pointed out, I mean, we've seen just a dramatic jump so quickly to rates that we haven't seen in years, if not up to a decade now at this point. And the first sector that is hit the hardest is housing. And we've discussed this on FS Insider with the team from Piper Sandler, talking about their HOPE framework, which I know that you're very familiar with. I'm just going to repeat it here for any of our listeners that aren't familiar with this. But basically, HOPE stands for housing, orders, profits, and employment. So that's basically the sequence of impacts that we see from a rise in interest rates. Housing is impacted first, then we see manufacturing orders, the O in HOPE, then corporate profits, and then lastly, employment. Employment is the last to react. And again, many people are looking at the economic landscape and they're saying, how could there be such a dire growth forecast when you see such strong employment numbers? That is the last shoe to drop, as you have mentioned in the past on our show. And so that's probably something that we're going to see in the months, if not well into 2023, when we see unemployment start to pick up. But with that said, you know, one of the big things that I think a lot of strategists that are looking at, and this is something that you also addressed recently, is what we see with interest rates. Because if the leading economic indicators are turning down and we are starting to see a deterioration in financial conditions, why aren't we seeing long rates also come down, since they do follow more closely the growth outlook? So what is some of your research telling you on this big topic that's being debated and discussed in the financial news media today?
You know, Chris, one of the charts that we showed in the investment meeting this week was how yields historically follow leading economic indicators. And the chart I showed was a 10-year treasury yield going back to 2010, as well as the ISM manufacturing PMI. And when you think about it, the ISM, both the ISM and the S&P are leading economic indicators. When you look at the conference board, they have a leading, a coincident, and a lagging index, and the yield curve and the ISM are both in the leading indicator. So they do provide basically a forward-looking view into the economy. And again, it's just as the ISM is a leading indicator of future growth, so are interest rates, as they are discounting future growth. And so when I showed that chart of the ISM and the 10-year treasury yield, you could see a very, very tight fit from 2010 all the way to 2020. But what we started to see, though, was that relationship began to break down in 2020. Now, we had a bottom in the ISM, and we did have a bottom in interest rates, but the recovery that we saw in the ISM was not matched by equivalent recovery by interest rates. So, for example, where we got to a little over 60 on the ISM, that was basically kind of correlating to a 3.25%, 3.5% yield on the 10-year treasury. But at the time, yields were roughly around 1.5%. So they certainly didn't rise as much as economic growth would expect them to. And the good reason for that was the Fed was aggressively buying treasuries, suppressing interest rates. And then what we started to see was economic growth in the latter half of last year began to slow and has really slowed down this year. And yet what we're seeing, especially with the Fed ending its QE program and now moving to quantitative tightening, or QT, by selling treasuries or letting them roll off its balance sheet, interest rates are rising in polar opposite of the direction that the ISM and other leading indicators would suggest. When you look at, for example, the Conference Board's LEI index, its year-over-year growth rate, that too really does track what we see in interest rates. So there's something off here. And part of it is, some people are saying, is that inflation is still sticky. But when you look at inflation, that is actually placed by the Conference Board in their lagging index. So inflation is not a leading indicator. It's not even a coincident indicator. And a good example of that is, you just study history, often at times the inflation rate peaks in the middle of a recession, not before. And the reason for that is typically commodities are the last asset class to peak. And those typically peak in the, you know, oftentimes in a recession. So that's why when you hear of, you know, late cycle investments, a lot of strategists will shift away from stocks and bonds and towards commodities, as that's when inflation tends to be the hottest. So when you look at interest rates, they really should not track inflation as much as they do economic growth. And so that's why I think, Chris, there's something else at play here, particularly when you look at market-based measures of inflation. So when you look at, for example, even consumer levels of inflation, so when you look at the Michigan's consumer sentiment findings for 1 year or long-term inflation expectations by the consumer, those are coming down. And when you look at other areas of market-based inflation, like break-even inflation rates, those peak back in the spring and they're well off their highs. So market-based expectations of future inflation are coming down, as is the consumer. So again, I think, Chris, there's something else at play as to why interest rates are, long-term interest rates are not reflecting current economic growth.
What about just a straight supply and demand argument? And, you know, I do want to point out that there's been some reporting about how foreigners are basically not buying U.S. treasuries. And so in that case, that's putting an upward pressure on yields. Is that exerting some influence on yields as you see it?
You're absolutely right, Chris. Typically, foreigners will take excess cash they have from a trade surplus and pour that back into the economies that they have the surplus with so that their currency doesn't strengthen overly and then hurt their exports to that country. A good example of that is the U.S. and China. The U.S. has a large trade deficit with China. It has for the last two decades. Historically, China has used that surplus and reinvested it in U.S. securities and has been a large buyer of U.S. treasuries. However, what we are seeing is that China and Russia have more or less moved away from U.S. treasuries. Russia has basically gotten rid of all their treasuries, you know, possibly as they were anticipating actions that they would take in Ukraine. But when you look at China, China too, since 2018, has steadily owned less and less U.S. treasuries. When you look back in 2018, China held about $1.2 trillion in U.S. treasuries, and that is now below a trillion. So it's roughly, give or take, $300 billion less than where they were just a few years ago. In contrast to China, Japan has seen a real steady increase in their holdings of treasuries, such that Japan is now the largest foreign owner of U.S. treasuries. They currently own a little over $1.2 trillion in U.S. debt. But as you mentioned, Chris, we do see some major changes this year. And in my opinion, I think they're energy related. We've seen a massive, massive reversal in trade flows between, for example, Japan, the European Union, and the United Kingdom versus other countries. So, for example, or even with the U.S., so when we look at Japan just a year ago had a pretty sizable trade surplus. That has evaporated to nearly the largest trade deficit in Japan's history. So clearly, Japan is not recirculating currency into other currencies and other securities. And then when we look at the Eurozone has run a trade surplus since 2013, and quite a sizable one. That has absolutely completely reversed, and it is now a trade deficit, the largest that we have seen in Europe's history. So a massive reversal in the trade balance for Europe. The same thing goes for a major exporter like South Korea. South Korea, obviously a huge hub of exporting of semiconductor chips. They saw a massive trade surplus. That has now evaporated to the worst trade deficit we've seen, I would say almost since the Asian currency crisis back in the latter 1990s. So there, Korea's had a complete reversal. And then when we look at the UK, a year or a year and a half ago, the UK had one of its largest trade surpluses in its history. That has evaporated to now the largest trade deficit in its history. And we have data going back to the 1950s. So a massive, massive swing in terms of trade. And the cause of this is clearly energy. These are countries that are not self-sufficient, and so they must import a tremendous amount of their energy, and they are doing so at significantly elevated prices than they have ever paid before. And so that is really hurting their balance of trade with not just the U.S., but other countries, you know, such as oil exporters and natural gas exporters. And so with these major regions not having trade surpluses, they don't have the assets to pour into and buy U.S. treasuries. So we're more or less seeing an absence of buying by pretty steady and consistent buyers of U.S. debt. And now we have the Federal Reserve, which is either selling or letting treasuries roll off its balance sheet as it's decreasing its holdings over time. Now, the other issue we're dealing with is we have ballooned the amount of debt the U.S. Government is carrying in response to the COVID crisis of 2020. Well, as this debt matures, we have to roll it over, and we're issuing new debt to cover our existing needs. And so what we're seeing is a pretty high overall issuance of debt in the U.S., and we're seeing a decline in traditional buyers, both from the Fed and from foreigners. So we essentially have a demand-supply mismatch, which is putting upward pressure on interest rates, causing them to diverge from economic growth.
So basically, as you pointed out, the Fed is stepping back as a buyer of U.S. Treasury bonds. Foreign countries are stepping back from buying. And let's dig into that latter point just a little bit more, because I think some in the perhaps more doom and gloom crowd, if we should call it that, would argue that foreign countries are stepping back from buying U.S. Treasury bonds because of larger concerns over America, an implosion of the U.S., mostly due to problems surrounding America, domestic American problems, high debt levels, for example, I think is the basic argument. But it sounds like what you're arguing is something quite different, that this has to do with the supply chain problems, the decade of aggressive ESG policies that are really starting to bite when we look at fossil fuel inventories and lack of inventories that have been built across Europe and other nations, and them having to aggressively import what they do not have. So it sounds like the focus is a little less on perhaps foreigners stepping back from the U.S. Treasury bond market because of concerns over America, but more because of their own issues that they're dealing with right now. Would that be accurate?
Yes, I do think it's essentially a continual fallout from energy prices that are elevated. And this really began to occur even before Russia invaded Ukraine. I mean, you look at the jump in natural gas prices, electricity prices in Germany, before even the invasion. The invasion just exacerbated the issue. And this has really turned these countries to a massive trade deficit as they import most of their energy needs. Now, what I'm concerned about and why we could possibly see long-term interest rates move higher even in the face of negative economic growth is the concern that energy prices could move higher. There's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, when you look at what the Biden administration has done this year, it has effectively flooded the market with oil. So if people asked me a year ago where I would expect oil prices to be if I knew that the Biden administration was going to unleash a massive amount of oil on the market, I would expect oil prices to be below 50, maybe even below 30 with supply to that degree. But oil right now is trading at $85 a barrel. It's really not that low, which is amazing because last week, the Biden administration in 1 week released 8.4 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. That was the single largest release of oil in 1 week in the history of our country. And you did not see oil prices collapse over the last week or significantly fall. They're rebounding today, again, over $85 a barrel. So the question I have to ask is, what's going to happen once the Biden administration is done flooding the market with oil, supposedly after the elections have passed? My thought would be, if oil, the massive release like that could not significantly drive oil prices lower, the absence of that selling, we're probably going to see oil prices continue to drift higher, and I would not be surprised before the end of the year that we see triple-digit oil again. There's that to contend with, and we also have the ban by the EU on imported oil and gas from Russia. So they're basically going to be scrambling for other places to buy their energy needs and competing with Asia and other countries and effectively driving oil prices higher. And then also, there is a bit of a concerning trend that we're starting to see, which was pointed out recently by Bloomberg's Javier Blas. And what he was talking about in a recent article he wrote was called "Houston, We Have an Oil Problem." And what he's noticing was when you look at estimates for U.S. oil production growth this year, you had estimates all over the map, but you had one bullish firm. They were estimating growth of 1 million barrels per day of increasing production versus 2021. ConocoPhillips was predicting growth as much as 900,000 barrels per day for this year. However, we're averaging a lot lower than that. And the reason for that is the amount of rigs that are being put into use to increase production is starting to stall. And what he was talking about in particular was the Permian Basin, which is the largest source of growth of U.S. oil production. And when you look at horizontal drilling wells in the Permian Basin, they peaked in July, and they're more or less going sideways. So to achieve those, 900,000 or million barrel per day growth estimate for this year, we need to continually to see the number of rigs in service rise, not stagnate. And so there's a really good chance that we could come in well below the estimates of ConocoPhillips or others in the industry. And that too, when you have a reduction in the supply, both by U.S. production, as well as the government not releasing oil from the strategic petroleum reserves, that could pressure oil prices higher here in the U.S. as well.
Okay, so there are a number of factors that are taking place here. But again, what you are identifying is how we are seeing a massive trade reversal globally, where some of the biggest buyers of U.S. Treasury debt in the past were doing so because they had trade surpluses, primarily with the U.S., with which they would recycle those surpluses back into U.S. treasuries. Now we are seeing those reverse to very wide deficits as countries scramble to restock energy inventories and deal with their own domestic economic troubles. So this, along with the Fed stepping back from purchasing U.S. treasury bonds, has led to a big spike in rates, and this is really starting to hit the economy. If rates do start to peak out here, however, and hit that 3.5% wall that we discussed earlier, what sort of signal do you believe that is giving?
Well, so I think it's pretty clear to see the impact of energy in terms of how it's influencing U.S. Interest rates. So what could help not see a spike in interest rates in the U.S. is if we have a much milder winter ahead, where oil prices, natural gas prices don't spike. That would mean less pressure on the trade deficits of those countries, which means that they may be able to, in the months ahead, actually start buying treasuries. We'll have to see on that. And then obviously the converse would be if we had a really nasty winter, that could really exacerbate things. But, as we talked about, Chris, in the beginning, despite a very sizable surge in short-term interest rates, the long end held steady more or less this week. Again, the 10-year is going to close this week below 3.5. The 30-year is basically right there at 3.51. If I see a failure of the long end of the yield curve to break out and possibly move down, what that would tell me is we're basically seeing other buyers step in. And that could be retail investors or other institutions who are buying long-term treasuries based on their forecast. A good example of that was this week, Jeff Gundlach, commonly known as the Bond King from DoubleLine. He basically said that people need to get more bearish. And he thinks the Fed is going too hard, that there's so much tightening already in the pipeline that they should be slowing down now, not doing these large rate hikes. And he thinks that you should be buying long-term treasuries to prepare for possible disinflation risk in 2023. And one of the things I did this morning is I looked at one of the largest long-term treasury ETFs, which is iShares TLT. That's the 20-year plus ETF. You can look at the amount of flows going into that ETF, even with it declining over the last 6 months or so, inflows are surging. So clearly, we're already starting to see some institutions take advantage of the significant decline in long-term treasuries, buying those. And that would tell me, Chris, if they fail to break out in yield and actually yields start heading lower, that the demand for treasuries out of concern for economic growth ahead are starting to pick up and overwhelming the lack of demand from foreigners and the selling by the U.S. Federal Reserve.
Well, Chris, I want to point out that, as of late last year, you began warning that we were seeing a possible topping pattern in the stock market. And as we moved closer into November and December was when you started looking at some major red flags and some sell signals that were popping up across all major indices and warned our listeners and many of our followers that we were likely to see some major pain heading into 2022. We saw that. You had warned, get defensive, raise cash. That's what we were doing. And throughout this market cycle, in the downtrend that we've seen this year, you've been pushing back against, calling for a major bottom. We did see a major bottom in June, strong bear market rally. That is now retraced. And as of this week, we broke below the very important 3,900 level that I know many strategists and even people on FS Insider, Avi Gilbert, to name one individual, we're looking at as a critical line of support. So at this point, it does appear as if the macro backdrop, the fundamental backdrop, as you've discussed with the leading economic indicators, the spike in interest rates and how this is translating through the economy, is still pointing for a defensive cautionary stance on the overall stock market. So I just want to give you kudos for giving our listeners such a good understanding of what's driving a lot of the events that we're seeing both in the economy and how that relates to the markets. So with that said, if any of you would like to get in touch with our asset managers or financial planners here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, you can give us a call at 888-486-3939, or you can go to financialsense.com and hit where it says contact us. Chris, thanks again for speaking with us, and we look forward to having you on in another 2 weeks.
If you aren't already, I do want to encourage you to watch our weekly investment updates, give you an inside look on what we are doing at Financial Sense Wealth Management, especially tied to our outlook on the market and the economy. You can find those on the video page on financialsense.com, or you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel where they're posted, and then you'll get regular notifications to those as well.
If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.